Okay. Looking at the plan for alternative practices and the Forrester's comments on them in terms of removing the trees that are already down and fallen in the stream, is your position that the tree should stay or that they should be removed?
Neither one. I don't know. And neither does the state. And neither does Stimson, because nobody's done the analysis to find out.
And what? Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
I won't even hazard a guess, to be perfectly honest. This is the kind of thing where you don't just on the back of an envelope or on the toss of a coin. In this case, on one side of the coin is $50,000 worth of timber for Stimson. On the other side is no bucks for Stimson. So, you know, where it falls, they certainly are going to care. But what's best for the resources is an unknown, because nobody has analyzed it.
Okay, and is that what you're really getting at? You want the analysis about what should be done with this timber that's already fallen?
Well, we have the situation that we have. And ideally, yeah, that analysis, everything that happens out there is one less option for the court and for the state forester. The trees are cut. I'd say, what is maybe there's 2 acres left up there. The timber is cut. The trees are laying on the ground. So now the only options that we have are to pick up all the logs and haul them to the mill, or leave some of them laying on the ground. And I wouldn't want to express an opinion. That is not my expertise. But it would require a real analysis. And if the best option is to remove all the logs, great. If the analysis suggests that we need downslope mitigation, great. Let's do those things. We have to make the best of the situation that we have.
Okay, and what do you think was faulty in Mr. Burns' second review? That is, why is his second review not adequate to protect the resources?
When he came out in response to the neighbors' concerns?
Correct.
I think he gathered some good data in that second, it's the first time that he had come to Spring Branch. But I do think that there are a number of things, and I went over some of those with Mr. Elbert. There's a lot of considerations, and I mentioned those. You know, one of them being that Mr. Lund's house is recessed into what is in fact an old debris fan. And the fact that it's lower than a lot of the surrounding territory makes it especially vulnerable. Also, I think that there's some questions about, Mr. Buren noted the presence of boulders, large boulders, on that fan feature. And those aren't moved easily. They are part of a fluvial debris fan. And identical observations were made on the drainage to the north I can't remember Wendy's last name, our neighbor in Kristen's house. Outside of this, there was the geosciences report. It's in evidence. And we can certainly look at that, but based on very similar evidence, location on a debris fan, the presence of large boulders. As a result of that, geosciences determined that that house was actually at moderate risk, and therefore a debris diversion structure was built to protect that house. So based on very, very similar evidence and very similar conditions, and I'd be happy to talk with Mr. Buren about this further, about what I see in the data. A different conclusion was made. As important as this is, again, we're talking about people's houses and lives and water. to open this up to a conversation and acknowledge, well, maybe there is a little more here. Maybe we should spend a little more time on this analysis. If Mr. Buren has 200+ of these kinds of reviews to do a year, he can't do this justice. Not to that level of importance and to the level of precision that the guidance and the rule would suggest is required here, given the importance of human life.
Okay, Mr. Kroll, I actually think that's all the questions I have for you at this point. Is there anything else you want to cover right now?
I think that's more than enough for me. Thank you, Judge.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. DeVore, any follow-up questions for Mr. Kroll?
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Kroll, you said you had 35 years experience in forestry-related fields. Can you expand on that a little bit? Tell us what your experiences have been.
Sure. I graduated from Oregon State University in 1988 with a bachelor's in forest management. I, during that time, worked fire crews and various odd jobs to get through school. I immediately got a job, actually before I graduated, with the Bureau of Land Management. I worked for 10 years as a silvicultural forester. Continued my work in fire, and in that job, of course, I managed the procurement and planting of a lot of trees, burning slash, we did a lot of firework, and I covered a lot of ground. I've seen a lot of landslides out there. I know where they happen, I know where they don't. It was a very boots-on-the-ground experience. My focus was on reforestation, and so we were planting units all over the North Coast Range, from Scappoose all the way down to Ebo. And I worked a lot in riparian areas. That was my focus. Since then, I've worked in a variety of different kind of jobs, and also developed two businesses along with my wife. We developed Ash Creek Forest Management, which is a reforestation and habitat management company. We've since sold that to our son and his partners. And we've continued, though, on our other business, which is Shoals Valley. That's our farm. That's where we live, and we grow trees and shrubs and plants for forestry and also for riparian restoration. I got the crazy idea to go get my PhD because I kept bugging my wife with questions that she couldn't answer. So she said, go find another place to get those answered. So I went and got my PhD at Oregon State. I completed that program this past fall. My research was in and is in plant genetics.
So just looking at kind of the silver cultural background and experience and the timberland experience, it sounds like it was mainly with the BLM, that you said, for 10 years. Is that right?
Correct.
And then reforestation, how long did you do work on reforestation as your own business?
Oh my gosh. Started that 1997. We sold it last, beginning of 2000, or the end of 2020. So,
13 years or so.
Yeah, no. I think, did I do my math wrong?
23 years. Sorry, I missed a decade there. Yep. And with that reforestation, were you doing more than just providing the trees? Were you actually leading crews out to do the reforestation?
You mean me personally?
Yes.
Was I doing the work on the ground?
Were you providing the trees for reforestation, or were you with your crews, or did you have crews that were out doing the work on the ground?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. We had crews, and I worked with the crews less and less over the years, and my back gave out, but yes, absolutely. I love it.
Okay. And then when Mr. Albert testified, he talked about meeting you and worked for, was it the city of Portland that you worked for?
That's correct.
And was, where did that fall into the your career?
So let's see, I worked for BLM until 1995, pardon me, And then I just got interested in kind of expanding my horizons, and I was just looking at a friend of mine handed me a job opening at City of Portland, and I applied and got it. And so I moved my family over to the Portland area and worked and went from working in the woods in Tillamook to working in downtown Portland, essentially, which was a culture shock. But I developed a program there at the City of Portland called the Watershed Revegetation Program, which still exists today.
How long did you work with the City of Portland?
Oh gosh, let's see, September 2001 was the last month I was at the City of Portland.
Okay. So from when to September of 2001?
It would have been the beginning of 1996, essentially.
Okay.
One of the first things that I did there, actually, was fill sandbags to keep water out of the wastewater treatment plant.
From the 96 floods.
96 flood, I remember it very, very well. My wife and kids got stuck in Tillamook because of the landslides and floods.
So shifting a little bit, your experience with the Oregon Forest Practices Act, I would imagine your reforestation work that led you to get some familiarity with reforestation, is that right?
Yes.
And
I would not say that I certainly am not an expert in Forest Practices Act.
Sure. And then that was my next question, specifically on the Division 623 and the rapidly moving landslides. Is it fair to say that most of your experience has been in the current situation where you're looking at Gale's Peak and trying to understand what's happening around you and how the rules apply? That's how you've gotten most of your or all of your experience on the Division 623. Is that accurate?
If you're talking about my experience specifically with the regulations and the written rules, absolutely. Yeah, this is a crash course in 623.
Yeah, but not something, in your experience as a silviculturist and a forester and reforestation, these were not rules that you had to deal with day in and day out professionally, right?
No, I didn't have to deal with landslide rules, just stay out of the way. I would say that I am now, I guess on the scale of expertise in this world of statute and rule and guidance, I am absolutely an expert relative to the general population, unwittingly,
yeah.
and so on.
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you earlier that I was expecting to see you hire yourself out as a consultant on these issues now.
I don't think so. No, thank you.
Okay. The slides that you offered as exhibits, did you have any help in putting those together, or were those your own work?
You're talking about all those Google Earth? Well, I got help from Google Earth.
Yeah. But as far as engineering assistance or, you know, other professional assistance in applying the analysis that you did there, did you have any help?
Unfortunately, it was all me. I've spent literally every waking hour for the last 2 months working on this.
Yeah. Did you seek any input from Mr. Elbert or from Mr. Buren or any other licensed engineer?
I talked with Mr. Elbert. Mr. Buren and I have not had a chance to have a broader conversation. And again, I enjoyed meeting Mr. Buren and would look forward to hopefully, I'll just invite y'all. Y'all can all come over and have a barbecue this summer, what do you say? Maybe we can talk about this stuff more. I would actually enjoy the opportunity to talk with Mr. Buren more. I think this is a misunderstanding of the rules. And just lack of time. I don't think that ODF has the time. The staff doesn't have time to corral all this stuff. It's a lot.
Yeah. One of the slides that I wanted to go back to was it showed you had superimposed a 130-acre slide over the top of the valley in front of your property.
Sure.
What were the conditions of that 130-acre slide? If you could just tell us, you know, geographically, what the basin was like, what the slopes were like, what led to that size of a slide?
You mean the okay, what would have led to a 130-acre slide? Yeah, I don't want to go too far down this track. I'll answer anything you ask me as best I can, but I acknowledged, and I think as everyone here who knows these resource issues knows, you can't predict what's going to happen. We can only try to anticipate as best we can with the evidence that we have. And I think that the Gami, it's a great resource. It's our own Department of Geology. We should take advantage of it and see what they say. And again, if you look at the basin here, if you're looking for what might happen, we're better to look than in the creek next door. We're better to look than the slope up the canyon here or further up the road, places that are close by. I would certainly question that kind of a hypothesis if I were comparing like Tanzania, slides in Tanzania due to slides here in Gales Creek. But wow, it's right here and it's our own resource from our very own Department of Geology.
But and in that same vein, isn't it important to look at the size of the basin and the slopes that led to that type of a debris field before you just plop a map on top of a flat valley?
You know, that's an absolutely excellent question and an excellent point, and I completely agree with that. Of course, and I would not build a thesis around this idea, but what I would say is that looking at your own guidance, I don't want to go too far down this track because I think it's beyond the scope of this hearing unless the judge allows us to talk about it, but it's absolutely a critically important issue. Your guidance is cookie cutter. It's absolutely cookie cutter, and it treats every basin the same, no matter how big it is, no matter how steep it is. The geometry that's prescribed in the tech notes is the same for every basin. And that doesn't make any sense. Bigger basins, steeper basins, are going to generate bigger flows. Smaller basins, less steep basins, are going to generate smaller flows. Yet there is no accommodation for that in your technique.
Wouldn't the impact ratings and the areas of more concern that we heard Mr. Guerin testify that those are two areas where professional engineering and use of professional judgment comes in to help provide some context for the site-specific evaluation. So it would be not just a cookie-cutter approach, but there would be the professional judgments involved. You'd have to agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. If there's the groundwork to support it, you have to look on the ground in order to move the needle on your cookie-cutter guidance. Another one with cookie cutter guidance, as long as it's informed by the reality.
I think the last question I wanted to ask relates to the 1 in 100,000 standard. That you pointed out that was in the Board of Forestry minutes. And would you agree that this is a staff report presented to the Board of Forestry? And that as part of that staff report, it also included a rule package that the board was being asked to vote upon?
I think that, yes. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't fully understand the words that you're saying to me.
Try and ask it differently, if that'd be better.
Yeah, would you please?
Sure. So if we look at your exhibit R6, and I don't know that we necessarily need to bring it up, you're familiar with the document. It cites to the 1 to 100,000 standard, and I'm asking if you would agree that this is a report from the board of a report from the department to the Board of Forestry, and that as part of this report, the Board of Forestry is adopting a set of rules.
I think that the rules are where the rubber hits the road. I think the fact that I think statutorily required, and certainly required in the rule, that the agency will adopt guidance to implement the intent. And again, I don't want to get too lost in this stuff because, by golly, you know, we're talking about public safety here. You know, and to have an objective standard in evaluating public safety and in opening the agency's methodology to the public that is affected seems absolutely appropriate here. I don't know if that access to, you know, to the process is codified anywhere, but I certainly hope that, you know, somehow there is some avenue for us to review. That just seems reasonable to me. I can't point to a statute or a rule, but if someone could help me out there, I'd appreciate it. We're talking about public safety. We're talking about the well-being of people down here in the community. And again, I'll repeat it again, people who don't have any ill will or ill intent towards anyone here. No other axe to grind. All we've asked for, all my family's asked for, is time and consideration. That's all. And an analysis that we can understand and replicate and, I and have differences with.
The standard that you've looked for, the 1 to 100,000, yes, that is stated in the board minutes and it's referenced in the tech note. But you would agree. You would agree that it is not included in any of the administrative rules that the board has passed. Do you agree with that?
I believe that standard, because it underpins these essential rules, is essentially required in the rule. And it references back to the rule. The rule is referenced in the guidance. And the guidance references the rule. And the rule requires the guidance. I think that this is not just something that you offhandedly think about. I think it is the fundamental. And again, I think people have been daunted maybe by that standard. How do you calculate it? Well, don't bother. Don't bother trying to calculate it that way. Calculate a realistic risk based on reasonably foreseeable circumstances. And I guess since we've got it open there, if you'll bear with me, that standard in mind, and that's an exacting standard. I think everybody will agree. It's like, we don't want people to die. Well, okay, I'm sure the legislature will agree with that. When you have that standard in mind, and then you go back and you look at the impact ratings and think about the words, I struggle with this. But I think I got it. So if we read unlikely, so they define unlikely, moderate, serious, and extreme. If you go back now with one death in 100,000 in the back of your mind, and you read this, unlikely impact rating indicates that any shallow, rapidly moving landslide initiating within the operation is unlikely to directly impact the structure or road. We go down to serious. Serious impact rating indicates that any shallow, rapidly moving landslide initiating the operation is likely to directly impact the structure or road. That doesn't mean any old shallow, rapidly moving landslide. It doesn't mean the average one. It doesn't mean the next one. It really suggests what it says. Any and all. That's what it means. And so now you think, oh, okay, so we're not just talking about the average debris torrent to them. We're talking about the one that's commensurate with the standard, which is one death in 100,000 exposures.
But that one death in 100,000 is not written into the rules. That's the main question that I wanted to ask. Just, I mean, yes or no, do you believe that one to 100,000 is a criteria in the rules?
I think that the rules require the development of a standard and the rules that support that standard. I don't think you can get around that. And if there is no objective standard, and I asked this of Mr. Buren, and I actually missed this examination because I should have asked, what is your definition of unlikely in this circumstance? If you don't have an objective standard to work to, what is, so substantial, so I think when you get to the final determination of risk to the public, we're talking about the categories of low, intermediate, or substantial, right? So in this case, when we get all the way to the very end of the calculation, we're talking about a low risk. We're talking about a low risk that somebody's gonna die. So what is low? What is Mr. Buren's or your or anyone else's definition of low when it comes to my life or my grandson's life or my neighbor's life? What is the definition of low? There has to be. You can't reference an entirely arbitrary standard. Mr. Buren's definition of low is not mine.
And Mr. Paul, are you wanting to see the Division 623 rules changed, or are you disagreeing with how the department interprets those rules?
I would have to do more analysis that I don't want to do to answer that question. I think that the guidance is okay. If my understanding of it is correct, I think the guidance is okay. I think it could absolutely be improved. Clearly, it needs to be improved in terms of communication so that we all understand what it means.
So you believe that the department is interpreting that guidance the wrong way?
I don't think it's just the department. And I think, I struggled with it myself. I like, how do I reconcile this one death in 100,000 with these impact ratings? It doesn't make sense until I read that word any. It's so important. Any.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carl. I don't have any other questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. DeVore. Mr. Denley, any questions on cross?
I just have a couple. Mr. Carl, I wrote down here that you have looked across the valley at Gales Creek, and you said something along the line that all the trees are cut. What did you mean by that?
I'm not sure I'm following you. I'm trying to recollect what I was talking about at the time. Up on the hill?
Yeah.
Well, they're not quite all cut. There's still a few up there. I'll look up another right now. I can tell you.
Yeah. A live update on what's going on up there, because I can see the whole thing.
I guess 2.5-3 acres still to cut up on top.
And those 2.5-3 acres that still have to be cut, those are away from the Type D stream, correct? That's in a different part of the Nordgren site.
Yeah, that's right. It's up at the top of the hill. The lower part of the slope's been cut for some time.
Okay. And I have down here that you want to have a discussion about whether...
Oh, I'm sorry. Could I hold you up here for just a quick second and just elaborate just a little bit on your question, or perhaps project, and you can stop me if I'm stepping out of bounds here legally. If I think what you're perhaps implying is that this thing is kind of a done deal, that it's moot, but it's not. It really isn't. We're talking about where do we go from here? How do we figure out?
Let me ask my question then.
Okay, sure.
What I understand you saying is that apart from the riparian area referenced by Mr. Jacobs in Exhibit 28, you want to have a larger conversation about what is to be done with all those logs on all the other areas of the Nordgren site that have been felled but not yet harvested. Leave them, harvest them, but you want to have that conversation.
On the ground? I'm not married to that idea. Like I said, I'm not the expert here. I'm not the person who ought to be determining whether the logs that are on the ground pose a greater risk or a lower risk if they're left there to the public. That's not my call. That would be really a conversation between Mr. Buren and Mr. Albert and other experts that they might choose to engage to help answer that very complicated question. You know, if I were to tell you what my preference is, I don't want to see logs laying there going to waste. That would just be spiteful. I just want a reasoned and accessible and accountable system that actually takes into account people's safety down here.
One of the things that you had talked about was this exhibit R5-4, which is this area where you had put into the valley slide, and Mr. DeVore asked you some questions about that. And what I have down here in my notes is, you know, that any depth that is could be in that one to 100,000 person formula kind of satisfies that standard. So, and what I have down here in my notes is that this is what you said, that this is a possible zone. You're not saying that it could happen, and you've never said that it did happen, correct?
Are you talking about my farm?
I'm talking about this red area in R5-4.
Let me open it up so I can just make sure I'm talking about the same thing you are. Right, okay, I'm with you now. Please ask your question again.
Okay, that area within the red, that's the possible area, conceivable area, you know, where a landslide could affect, correct? That's my interpretation of this.
Okay, there you go. No, I wouldn't argue with those words, but I think what I would say is if you want me to try to reinterpret it and be as precise as I can, given the standard and the evidence that we have, it's worth exploring all of the possibilities. And we have an easy reference. We don't even have to leave our easy chair to pull up the Slido website, do a little bit of calculation, project a polygon from one part of this basin to an area almost immediately adjacent, and say, okay, if we're trying to explore the outer limits of this thing, this would be a reasonable approach. Now, is it going to happen? Not likely. But again, we're talking about a standard of 1 in 100,000. I'm not sure that I would place that bet. I'm not sure that I would place the bet that I am outside of the danger zone when it comes to that particular standard. And I also want to make sure that we're clear. And that's one of the reasons I wished I had the broader map, because you would see that this blaze of red that we have here in the Gales Creek Valley is really unique. And this is a piece of ground that deserves more attention. I think if nothing else, the whole point of the Dogami, all the tax money that went into supporting the Department of Geology and developing these maps, the reason for the maps is to look out for public safety. And so we ought to look at that blaze of red for exactly what it is. It's a blaze of red. This is a worry zone. Let's be careful. Let's do the analysis.
I take it that Mr. Albert did not see this R5-4.
I don't think I showed it to him. No, I wouldn't have had time to do that, I don't think.
So just for those of us not steeped in forestry, what is silviculture?
Growing trees. Silva, which means it's the Latin for tree. Culture is culture. Growing.
All right. Thank you.
Are those all your questions, Mr. Denley?
It is.
Okay,
they
great.
Are.
Let's see. Mr. Gray, any follow-up questions for Mr. Kroll?
No, thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. All right. Mr. Kroll, anything else from you today?
I think everybody's heard way more than enough from me.
Okay. All right. Okay, so I'm just going to check in with each of the parties to see if there's any more testimony we need to take, and then if not, we'll maybe take a short break, and then we could come back for closings. But let's talk a bit. Mr. Kroll, any other testimony from you or any witnesses today?
No, thank you, Judge.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. DeVore, what about from the department?
Nothing more from the department. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Denley, anything from Bighorn Logging today?
Nothing.
Okay. And Mr. Gray?
No, thank you.
Okay. So it sounds like we're done with testimony at this point. And so I think we need to move on to closing statements. I want to do oral closings. Let's see. We're at 3:30. How long would the parties like? I want to give you a short break to kind of compose your thoughts and get ready for closings, but I don't want to take too long so we can also get out of here at a reasonable time. Mr. DeVore, how long of a break might you like?
Oh, I would appreciate 5 minutes would be fine.
Okay. Mr. Denley, what about you?
That's fine.
Mr. Kroll, how long would you like?
5 minutes is fine.
Okay. And then, Mr. Gray, is Stimson planning to do a closing argument today?
We are not.
Okay. Okay, so let's take like a 5 minute break. Let's see, it's 3:38, so let's come back at, it's late, I can't do the math. Let's say 3:45, to be safe. And then we will move to closings. Mr. Kroll, I'm going to have you do your closing argument first, if you are willing. Then I'll give Mr. DeVore a chance, and then Mr. Denley, and then Mr. Kroll, you can have a short opportunity to do a final, very short closing if there's anything else that came up in response to what Mr. DeVore and Mr. Denley say, okay? Okay, great. So we'll resume in about 5 minutes. Thanks, everyone. All right, we are at 3:45, so we're back. So Mr. DeVore, Mr. Denley, Mr. Kroll, Mr. Wagon Blast, back with us, Mr. Buren. It looks like Stimson Lumber, I can see your camera's back on. Okay, I think we're good. Looks like everyone's back. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started with closing statements. My only request would be is if you're going to cite to any statutes or any case law or anything like that in your closing statements, just slow down a little during that part to make sure I can keep up with you in my notes. Okay, Mr. Kroll, any questions before we get started?
I don't think so. Thank you, Judge.
Okay. Mr. Kroll, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
I think most of everything that I would say, I guess if I could ask a question from Judge. So I had written a closing statement, but I think I've covered an awful lot of this already in my testimony.
Okay.
And so I don't know that I don't want to waste people's time with it. So would it be acceptable for me to submit this to you directly or in writing, or what's your preference?
How long is it? You said you wrote it up. Is it on a computer?
It's 3 pages. I could go ahead and read it if you prefer that I read it into the record. I can do that.
I think that would be my preference, just because I want to get the record closed, if at all possible, so that I can start, you know, start the 5-day timeline and get this out to the parties. But Mr. Kroll, if you've gone over a lot of it, if you're kind of reading through and you want to omit parts or whatever, you're welcome to. But also, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm just going to start out by saying that, you know, public safety, drinking water, these are two important elements of this, what we're doing here in forestry. We have to be mindful of this stuff. Government accountability is not a bad idea, too. Communication can go a long way towards preventing the need to even have these kinds of hearings. And I'd be happy to contribute and participate in that in whatever way I can. I expressed an interest in this piece of ground a long time ago to all the people who are in a position to manage it. And communication really would help a lot. In a meeting of the parties before this hearing, Mr. McKibben at Stimson asked me, who do you think you are to challenge the experts at ODF? I'm paraphrasing. I'm sorry, Mr. McKibben, but I think that was the gist of what you were saying. I wasn't prepared to answer that question at the time, but I appreciate the reminder. And now I'll always remember the answer. I'm a United States citizen, and I have a right to challenge my government. Beyond this, I'm a husband, a father, and a grandfather. I'm a business owner. I care about my neighbors, my employees, and my family. I got through forestry school working fire crew, doing odd jobs, and pumping gas. And I've worked in the field as a forester ever since. I've walked across tens of thousands of acres in the North Coast Range, where Northern HL is being logged now. And I've seen landslides and debris flows, and I know where they occur in the landscape and where they do not. I have a fundamental grasp of scientific methods and natural resources, and I am questioning whether ODF has the staff time and commitment to protect the interests of people of this state when it comes to critical issues of water quality and public safety. I've reached out numerous times to ask simply for consideration of my neighbor's water supply and my family's safety. I've asked for time to understand what is going on in a complex and potentially dangerous natural resource setting, and to beg for an opportunity to inform a process that seems to be wired solely for the purpose of facilitating the extraction of logs while giving the appearance of being a public process. I've been rebuffed by my own state government. This court has an opportunity in this case to improve government accountability under one of the most far-reaching statutes in Oregon. The Forest Practices Act was designed by the legislature protects both environmental and social values of forests, Oregon's single most valuable natural resource. On private industry lands, the economic value of forests is primary, but not entirely exclusive of other interests. Foremost of these interests is public safety, and in very limited cases, public safety trumps timber dollars. Because of the high values on both sides, it is critical that the government get the balance right. To have a balance at all requires the government to have, whenever possible, an objective standard against which the public may measure and, if necessary, challenge the government's decisions. Under its authority to develop public safety policy, the Board of Forestry has set a lawful standard for forest practices in landslide-prone areas. 1 life in 100,000. This is the limit beyond which the economic interests of private industry take a back seat and the value of human life prevails. In the intervening 20 years since codified by the board, ODF seems to have missed this standard and replaced it with an entirely arbitrary one. state forester, through the testimony of Mr. Buren, has acknowledged that he was unaware of the meaning of this standard, which is reported in Tech Note 6, and that he has not applied this standard to his analyses of high landslide hazard areas in the Northern HL unit and elsewhere. Mr. Buren also testified that he spent no time in the field within this basin to make observations necessary for reliable analysis, as required in the agency guidance. In its decision making, the government should hold public safety and the safety of anyone potentially affected by its decisions as a central concern. In examination, Mr. Denley asked Mr. Jacobs if the safety of Bighorn's employees was a consideration in the state forester's decision on the plan for alternate practice. This is a legitimate concern for Bighorn. Just as the safety of my neighbors, employees, and family are mine, neither of our interests, however, permit the government to make decisions arbitrarily and in conflict with its own rules and policy. In this case, coincidentally, the government has awarded Stimson Lumber with $50,000 worth of logs that were improperly cut and had fallen into what was supposed to be a buffer for a family's drinking water supply. ODF overlooked this water right, a family's water, and then ignored honest information provided by the public, allowing even more of the buffer to affect. As a result, and as acknowledged in Mr. Jacobs' testimony, the portion of the stream closest to the water intake is now exposed to the elements. The question is, who is responsible for this damage? And I think this is kind of important. I don't know if it can be resolved here or not. But repeatedly through this process, in the testimony in this case, the state forester has claimed that this project is in compliance with the Forest Practices Act. The state forester has defended Stimson Lumber because Stimson acted on erroneous information from the department. The department has claimed that it holds no responsibility because it does not, by statute, authorize the actions of Stimson. This leaves the public without even the courtesy of an acknowledgement of responsibility.
This is ALJ Triana. Is there anyone else on the hearing that can hear me?
Welcome to WebEx. Enter your access code or meeting number for... If you're the host, save a phone number in your preferences to join the meeting as the host, or press pound now to join as an attendee. After the tone, say your name, followed by pound.
ALJ Kate Triana.
The host has not joined the meeting. Please stand by. If you're the host, save a phone number in your preferences to join the meeting as the host, or press pound now to join as an attendee.
Okay. I think we have a couple options. Monica, is the bridge working as far as you know?
As far as I know, our conference bridge is working. Folks, just so you know, that's just a toll-free number that you can call in on.
We didn't hear the judge.
You didn't hear her at all. Okay, go ahead. Can you say that again?
Oh, yeah. I was just asking whether the phone bridge was working and if the parties would want to call in. We have a separate phone bridge that we can use that's separate from all our internet. And maybe we could finish this up on the phone today, or we would have to reconvene tomorrow by WebEx, I think.
This is Matthew Denley from Bighorn. I am on a plane tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Okay.
Judge Triana, do you want to do closing this way if the parties are okay with it? Do you want to just stay on my speakerphone and do this, and hopefully maybe the system will come back up for the agency?
You think that's the best option, Monica?
I think it's what the parties and you are comfortable with, but I mean, we're recording this, and I think it would be no different than if you called in on the conference bridge. Everyone's here. I can stay on and turn my camera off. Y'all don't need to see me here, but and I can keep my phone on like this, and if everyone's okay with that. And Judge, if it would help you, I can go through and do a poll and see if anyone has any objection to us wrapping up today this way.
Everybody's pretty good at speaking up, so if anybody has an objection to this mode, just unmute yourself and speak up now. Okay, it doesn't sound like it. So, I apologize profusely for this. Mr. Kroll, when I got kicked out of the conference, the last thing I heard you talking about was the department has claimed no responsibility because Stimson is responsible for compliance with the FPA. That's kind of where I lost you. Would you be able to pick up from there? Perfect.
Okay. Statutes, rules, and agency policy are clear. Public safety and drinking water are two concerns the state forester and private timber companies are required to consider and protect. In the case of public safety concerns from landslides and debris flows, there is no exception. ORS 527-710, paragraph 10, states, the board shall adopt rules to reduce the risk of serious bodily injury at Fort Talbot caused by a rapidly moving landslide directly related to forest practices. This means all forest practices, whether through notification or a plan for alternate practice. OAR 629-623-0100, paragraph 1, states, the state forester will use further review area maps and or other information to screen proposed operations for high landslide hazard locations that may affect exposed populations. This means all operations. Stimson's proposed operation and the plan for alternate practice will be occurring within an area that encompasses a very high proportion of high landslide hazard locations, as shown in Exhibit 827. And there are protected structures downstream. The state forester is required, therefore, to consider the impact of the proposed operation on public safety based on a rapidly moving landslide and a public safety analysis. In his comments on the proposed operation, the state forester appears to be relying on these.
Has joined the meeting.
Appears to be relying on the existing analysis, but this analysis is invalid because, based on Mr. Guerin's testimony, it was performed in a manner that does not comply with agency policy in fundamental ways. In Tech Notes 2 and 6, which provide the specific guidance on evaluation of public safety risk, the word field appears 12 times, and the word site appears 26 times. The clear expectation in this guidance that this critical public safety analysis is site-specific and requires in-depth investigation of conditions on the ground within each basin where operations could affect downstream safety.
Mr.
Mr. Kroll, I'm going to just interrupt. Judge Triana, someone joined us, and I'm not sure. I just got notification someone joined this meeting, and I'm not sure who joined us, but I want that noted on the record. And I think it's someone who just called in maybe a couple minutes ago, if you could identify yourself.
Okay. Did somebody just call in? Please unmute yourself.
I'm sorry, if you, I heard something, but it wasn't very clear.
Sounds like he's open.
Oh, Keith Baldwin?
That was a yes, Judge Triana.
Okay. He is one of our, he's with Department of Forestry. He was one of our witnesses. He may be having the same technical issues we are.
Okay. I just wanted to let everyone know that someone had just joined us, so. And thanks, everyone, for your patience. We just got confirmation that it's a statewide outage, so. It's bigger than just us. All right, go ahead, Judge. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Thank you. Mr. Kroll, go ahead whenever you're ready.
Check note 6 specifies a number of specific factors for consideration in the analysis, including material presence in stream channels that could be carried downstream. An eventuality that the state forester has identified specifically in his comments on the proposed operation. At issue here is the proposal to remove trees which have already been cut and are laying in or near the stream. As stated in Tech Note 6, the role of downwood in debris torrent movement is not clear. The guidance goes on to suggest that downwood may play a beneficial role in stopping debris torrents higher in the basin than they otherwise might, actually reducing downstream effects. Again, the state forester is required to take actions that protect public safety. Forester overlooked a water right and a type D stream. ODF did not follow the requirements of its own guidance, including the specific elements that are called for in administrative rule. They did not perform the required field measurements in the development of the analysis, did not perform the kind of required field examination in Spring Branch, and did not apply the proper standard in the analysis. Again, Judge Triana, I'm respectfully asking you to rescind the comments of the state forester and require him to perform a new analysis with regard to the proper standard. With this new analysis, hopefully, we can make the best of the situation as it is. I want Stimson to make 2x4s. I've got a remodel to finish, and wood is expensive. I don't want to make it more expensive by tying up the land base any more than necessary to protect public safety. But this is a unique area. It is steep and has a dramatic history of slides and destructive debris flows, and there are people here. We are not asking for too much. Stimson, a little communication, advance notice, and planning will go a long way toward keeping your friends and neighbors on board. A significant portion of the Norgren HL unit could probably have been cut without excessively heightening the risks for the folks down the hill. With appropriate mitigation, this all could have been fine, and everyone down here would be on board. This is an extraordinarily challenging situation to navigate. I'm honored, though, to be able to participate in our legal process, a process which we should all cherish. We greatly appreciate everyone's time and continue to hope for collaboration and positive outcomes wherever possible. Thank you, Judge Triana.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kroll. I appreciate that, and I apologize for the multitude of interruptions during your closing remarks. Thanks for hanging in there. Okay, Mr. DeVore, we're going to move on to your closing statement. Whenever you're ready, you can go ahead.
Thank you, ALJ Tagana. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you. So getting back to the issue statement that we provided and we agreed upon in this matter, the essential issue is whether to affirm, modify, or rescind the Forester's comments on Stimson's statutory written plan and the plan for alternate practices. This is a fairly narrow and limited scope of review. There certainly are other forums available to address issues such as revising the rules. The shallow, rapidly moving landslide rules are under the Board of Forestry authority, and there is the opportunity to petition for rulemaking or to ask the board to revise those rules. There are also statutes involved with protecting the public from landslides that could be revisited through the legislature. And then there's the budgeting process to find more resources for the department to be able to devote more staff time to the work that's already there. Those are a few forums that are available, and there certainly are many other forums. But for the purposes of this hearing, we have a fairly narrow issue, and it's limited to what the stewardship forester's comments were. Here, there were three different written plans submitted by Stimson Lumber regarding the Nordgren HL operation. The first one was the non-statutory written plan for timber harvesting in a high landslide hazard location. This written plan was required by Division 623. Specifically, it was OAR 629-623-0700. And this document is in Exhibit A09. The Stewardship Forester provided comments on this plan, which are contained in Exhibit A10 on page 2. The written plan is required by rule, not statute, and therefore described as a non-statutory written plan in OAR 629-605-0170, subsection 10. The non-statutory written plan does not have a right to a contested hearing to challenge the forester's comments and is not subject to the review in this hearing. I would note, though, in response to Mr. Carl's comments, the non-statutory written plan is based on a geotechnical review by Michael Buren. There was testimony from Mr. Buren that he followed the department's statutes and rules and guidance when he developed his geotechnical report. Tech Note 2 lays out 5 steps that are required for a geotechnical review. First case of that review being a desktop review. Mr. Buren testified that he completed all of those steps. He testified that he conducted 2 different site visits and was able to talk to the landowners on multiple occasions. He conducted a thorough analysis of this site in reaching his conclusions. And as a professional engineer in these types of reviews, he has to exercise professional judgment in reaching his conclusions, and that is what he did here. He has extensive history and experience in conducting these reviews and followed the right process to finish this review as well. The second plan that was involved in this case was the statutory written plan for an operation that occurs within 100 feet of a Type D stream. This written plan was required by statute, specifically ORS 527.670, subsection 3A, and it is in Exhibit A14 on page 1. Stewardship Forester Eric Jacobs provided comments on this plan, which are in Exhibit A28. Since this is a written plan that's required by statute, it's under the scope of a statutory written plan as defined in 629-605-0170, subsection 2. And statute for statutory written plan statute provides that any person adversely affected or aggrieved by an operation that requires a statutory written plan may request a hearing if the person submitted written comments pertaining to the operation. And that is referenced in 527.700 subsection 3. This statutory written plan was required because it was a Type D stream within the operation unit. And I would like to address the designation of the stream initially as a Type N stream because there was it was in the map layer as not a fish-bearing stream or a fish use stream, and also not a domestic water source stream. The Department of Forestry collaborates with other agencies, agencies that have special expertise in various areas. For a fish use stream, there would be collaboration with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to determine a water use. The department would collaborate with the Water Resources Department. And there was testimony in this matter that when forestry looked to see whether this was a domestic stream or whether there was a domestic stream in the operation unit, it relied on maps from the Water Resources Department. This is a reasonable pull-up. Agencies collaborate routinely. When the stewardship forester reviewed the proposed or the notification of operation, the maps that were available at that time showed that there was a point of diversion for a domestic water source in an area that was north of the operation unit, and therefore there were no protected resources identified that required special protection in the operation unit. Based on that information, Simpson proceeded with logging and logged into the stream, the riparian zone of the stream, that is the subject of concern here. When the stewardship forester learned that the information on the map did not match what was on the ground, Derek Jacobs took quick action to investigate that on the ground and to see that the point of diversion was actually in the unit. Within hours, he conveyed that to Simpson Logging, who agreed to stop their operations in the riparian zone. Unfortunately, much of that area had been harvested and the logs were on the ground, but ODF acted reasonably, and as soon as it learned the information, it investigated it and took action. The third plan in this case is a written document that is a plan for alternate practices for streamside vegetation protection that deviated from the Forest Practices Act, specifically the rule that was going to be the alternate practice was in an alternate to OAR 629, 642, 0400, subsection 2. This was a riparian vegetation retention standard that could not be achieved because the trees had already been harvested when the stream was classified as a Type N stream. The plan for alternate practice was required by other administrative rules, including OAR 629, 605, 0173, and OAR 629, 642, 0700. The plan for alternate practices was attached to the statutory written plan and contained in Exhibit A14 on pages 2 and 3. The riparian protection rules in Division 642 explain that operators must protect streamside vegetation, but it also specifically allows for a plan for alternate practices and encourages operators to develop site-specific vegetation retention prescription for protection of the riparian zones of Type D streams. The plan for alternate practice must be approved by the forester or the stewardship forester as the designee, who then would also provide comments back to the operator on the plan. If the plan for alternate practice, as it is here, is proposed as part of a written plan that's required by ORS 527-670, subsection 3, for protection of vegetation along a Type D stream, then the forester's comments on that plan are subject to a hearing as provided in 527.670 1.700 sub 3. And this process is explained more in the department's rules in OAR 629, 605, 0173, subsection 3. But in this case, there's only two of those three plans that have a right to a contested hearing. The department plan for harvesting while within 100 feet of the Type B stream, and then the plan for alternate practices for allowing specific vegetation retention prescriptions along that Type B stream. The stewardship forester, as a designee of the state forester, made comments on both plans, which are in Exhibit 828. And then, consistent with statute, Mr. Crawl requested a hearing, claiming standing as a person adversely affected or aggrieved who had submitted comments pertaining to the operation. Statute further provides that after the hearing, the board's authority would be to affirm, modify, or rescind the comments of the state's minister. Again, a fairly narrow scope of review that the board has jurisdiction to consider, and hence is the subject of this hearing. So stepping through each of the plans and the comments separately, starting with the statutory written plan, the stewardship forester's comments were, quote, "Fully implementing this written plan will likely achieve the resource protection standards of the Forest Practices Act. This operation will be evaluated on the basis of how well required resource protection is achieved." These comments were specifically in response to Stimson's written plan for how it would meet the Forest Practices Act obligation in regards to protecting the riparian zone of the Type D stream. We heard testimony from Stewardship Forester Eric Jacobs that he believed that based on the written plan and the conditions on the ground, that the written plan would likely achieve the requirements of the Forest Practices Act. We also heard testimony from Keith Baldwin that this is a fairly standard language that stewardship foresters will put into their comments, and that it is appropriate on its face, but ultimately evaluation of the plan would depend on the actual implementation in the field. The plan for alternate practices also included stewardship foresters' comments, and those comments covered three separate grounds. The first comment acknowledged that the plan for alternate practices was seeking to implement an alternative to the vegetation requirements for protection of riparian zones. Because harvesting in the riparian zone had occurred before ODF had notified Stimson that it was a Type B stream in the harvest unit. The stewardship forester's comments were appropriate in this situation to acknowledge that Stimson was acting on information that ODF had conveyed to it. And the comments were accurate, the subject was appropriate to address. And as Keith Baldwin also testified, these were comments that were appropriate to make to Stimson to set the stage for the reason for the alternate plan. The second piece of that comment summarized the buffers that were being proposed in the plan for alternate practice and acknowledged that the plan provided protection of riparian areas that went beyond what the Forest Practices Act required. Again, this comment was appropriate because it acknowledged the relevant portions of the plan and gave an accurate assessment of how the plan exceeded the Forest Practices Act requirements. The third component of the forester's comments related to the trees that were downed within the riparian management zone. They were felled but had not yet been removed. The comment recommended removing the trees for three reasons. Each of these reasons are based on protection of the riparian zone and to promote vegetation in the zone. The first reason was that removal of the trees would mitigate the potential that the trees could be captured in a debris torrent and damage the riparian zone and areas downstream. The second reason was that removal of the trees would reduce the safety risk to operators who are working in the riparian zone as they removed slash and other debris to help the riparian zone recover. Third, removal of the trees would facilitate restoration and reforestation of the riparian zone. So all three of these reasons in the forester's comments for removing the downed trees are focused on protecting the riparian zone. removal of the trees was not a public safety measure that required a Division 623 analysis for steep slopes. The Division 623 analysis was already conducted for the entire operation unit. The forester's comments here were focused on protection of the riparian zone and the vegetation in that zone. The comments indicated that removal of the trees was required to protect the riparian zone, and certainly the comments are not, or the decisions are not made in a vacuum. Stewardship Forester Jacobs consulted with several people, including Mr. Buren for the geotechnical review, and also including Keith Baldwin for statewide consistency. That input all led to his recommendation to remove the trees. But the fact that that consultation occurred, even with the geotechnical specialist, does not somehow open the door into challenging the Division 623 non-statutory written plan or the comments on that plan just because there was consultation that led to the comments. As the ALJ and the Board of Forestry consider whether to affirm, modify, or rescind the comments, it's important to keep in mind that the comments were intended to, it's important to keep in mind what those comments were intended to address. The comments on the statutory written plan and for alternate practices were required to focus on protecting the riparian vegetation consistent with Division 642. Therefore, any changes to the comments must also focus on measures to protect the riparian vegetation of the Type D stream. In this situation, the Stewardship Forester's comments were all well-reasoned and appropriate and should be affirmed as written. Mr. Kral has come to a different interpretation of the relevant statutes and rules. Based on his interpretation, ODS should implement the Division 623 rules differently, do a different type of analysis than what has been done, and he believes that that would then lead to a different set of comments, and that the ALJ and the Board of Forestry should then adopt that new set of comments based on a new analysis. Mr. Kral has been clear that he wants to see a more extensive evaluation of the landslide risks, though it's other than saying more time and more evaluation, it's not very clear how he would implement Division 623 rules differently, only that he wants to see the department take more time to conduct a more thorough analysis. Mr. Kral offered the testimony of Ken Elbert to provide an alternative perspective on the engineering analysis. I would argue that Mr. Elbert's testimony is not persuasive for a few different reasons. First and most importantly, Mr. Elbert does not have experience in applying the Forest Practices Act to timber harvest operations. The fundamental principle here is that ODF must follow its statutes and rules. Mr. Elbert is not familiar with the statutes, the rules, or the ODF guidance. He offered his opinion on how he'd approach some of the thorny questions, but was unable to ground his analysis with any of the rules that apply. Second, Mr. Elbert has not conducted any meaningful evaluation of the site. He did not testify to any level of analysis other than a site visit that lasted less than 3 hours. He testified he has not reviewed records in this proceeding. It's really unclear what factual background he was relying upon to offer any sort of a professional judgment. Third, I feel like I have to address the fact that Mr. Elbert's professional engineering license is no longer active and has been inactive since the end of 2019. In statute, both ORS 627.020 and 672.045, the legislature has directed that a person may not engage in the practice of engineering without having a valid certificate to practice issued in accordance with the ORS 672 statute. Also, in statute, the legislature defines the practice of engineering in 672.005 supplement to include a wide range of activities, including consulting. This goes well beyond just placing a stamp on original work, but I am concerned if it would include testifying in front of an administrative law judge using his professional experience. These requirements are further explained in administrative rules, including OAR 810-0520, which provides that how he believes Ogieff's interpretation or analysis or comments are wrong. Mr. Crawl does not offer an alternative interpretation of Ogieff's rules. And even if he did, or to the extent that his comments could be perceived as a different interpretation, this really isn't a question of whether ODF or Mr. Paul has a better interpretation of the rules. Courts will give deference to an agency's interpretation of its own rules, provided the interpretation meets the low bar of being plausible. That deference provided to any agency in interpreting its rules is especially strong when the rules are technical in nature. And I would cite for the State v. Acosta case 112-4F-191 from 1992. The department's interpretation here, as expressed in the Tech Notes 2 and Tech Notes 6, and as testified today and last week, is it's not only a plausible interpretation, but it's a rational and comprehensive approach to implementing the requirements of Statute 527.710, subsection 10, as well as the Division 623 rules. And finally, in closing, in this forum, Mr. Kroll has requested a hearing to challenge the Forester's comments. He bears the burden to prove that his position is correct and that comments should be changed. However, I would argue that he has not provided convincing evidence that the Forester's comments were incorrect or would otherwise require modification. Therefore, the department would ask the ALJ to affirm the Forester's comments on both the statutory plan and the plan for alternate practices. With this conclusion, the department would respectfully request that Mr. Crawl's request for reimbursement of his expenses be denied. There are certainly some larger issues here that deserve continuing conversation, and I know that the department is offered and willing to continue to engage in those conversations. But for the limited scope of what can be reviewed in this hearing, I would ask the ALJ to affirm the Forester's comments and deny the request for expenses. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. DeVore. Mr. Denley, whenever you're ready, you can go ahead with your closing.
Thank you, Judge. Bighorn actually adopts what Mr. DeVore has testified or argued in his closing arguments on behalf of the Oregon Department of Forestry. ODF is correct that the issues before you today are narrow and limited to the plan for alternative practice under the Exhibit A 28. Despite the extremely narrow issues there, Mr. Crawl wants to have a larger, more expansive review of the rules, statutes, and guidelines set forth by ODF to address larger issues with public safety, with drinking water, with government accountability, better communications, and perhaps other issues as well. It's Bighorn's logging's position that the request for hearing filed by Mr. Crawl really asserts a position for which he had no probable cause to believe that his position was well-founded, given the narrow scope of the plan for alternative practices limited to OAR 629-642-0400 sub 2, and as further described in that administrative rule. In addition, Mr. Crawl's request for hearing of the plan for alternative practice dealing with Chapter 629, Division 642, appears to be made primarily for a purpose other than to secure appropriate action by the board. As evidence of those two items, Bighorn would point out that much of the testimony submitted by Mr. Crawl and the arguments made
deal with issues outside the riparian area addressed in the plan for alternative practice. We've spent considerable amount of time on larger issues dealing with landslide under Chapter 629, Division 623. We have dealt a significant period of time with perhaps having better communications to something called ferns. We've had a significant period of time dealing with what he describes as the objective standards of the substantial risk determination. Also the issues raised by Temper Notes 2 and 6. Those are outside the plan for alternative practice. Those are larger, perhaps systemic issues that Mr. Krall wants to raise relative to how ODF applies rules to more specific areas as opposed to just the riparian area addressed in Exhibit A28. As further evidence of a position that really had no basis to be a benefit to be secured by the board or a position to be held, it appears to be Mr. Krall's, he's come up with a new standard as far as I can tell, that whether a risk of harm or a substantial risk is a mere possibility is actually addressed in the rules. If you look back at the rules in Techno 2, it's really a more likely than not standard, not a possibility standard. In addition, even in Mr. Krall's request for a hearing, what he was really asking for was more time, and that's been a pretty consistent argument throughout the course of the litigation. And in the absence of a stay and the posting of a bond, there really is no basis to ask for more time. It really is just those issues raised and addressed by Mr. DeVore in Exhibit 28. I think that the judge should find that Mr. Buren did a statutorily and administratively competent review of those areas where HL and HL areas are involved. He listened to went to the maps and the statutes and everything else he was supposed to do. He met with Mr. Krall, Mr. Lund. He went to the site twice and submitted a second review dated March of 2022, which again went through all of the information that he had originally, and then incorporated all the information provided to him by Mr. Krall and others. Mr. Buren has the experience, he has the engineering degree, he has all those necessary elements to come to a decision that meets those statutory requirements. And based upon that, Mr. Jacobs came up with these, reviewed the written plan and also the plan for alternative practice. That is an area where Mr. Krall kind of wants us to focus on. He wants to figure out what to do with the wood on the ground, the trees on the ground. But that is really outside the scope of what the judge has to decide today. You know, listening to the testimony of Mr. Buren, Mr. Jacobs, and Mr. Baldwin, I was impressed with the level of expertise, the level of involvement, and really the seriousness that they took the review of their duties relative should find the same thing. Paul can look out of the window and he can see most of the timber is down now in the northern area. I would argue at least some of this is now moot, because what he wants now is a conversation about whether or not those trees stay on the ground or not, and that is simply beyond the scope of the alternative practice statement. Like Mr. DeVore and ODF, I would be remiss in pointing out that neither Mr. Krall nor Mr. Elbert really have a plan to what to do with the riparian area addressed in Exhibit 28. They point out that sometimes if you can leave the trees and it'd be a problem. If you take the trees out, it'd be a problem. They really don't have a plan in that regard. And I think that is fatal to the dispute that he's raising relative to the plan for alternative practice, because a specific plan on what's wrong with the plan has not been identified. And even if it were identified, I don't think that Mr. Elbert is the person who can actually set forth the plan, which he did not. He admitted that he's not an expert in the Forest Practices Act. He has a very limited experience in these kinds of areas. He hasn't really looked at the statute. He hasn't looked at the administrative rules. And he doesn't hold a current valid engineering license. And notwithstanding the fact that he doesn't seem to be overtly concerned in that, I found was pointed out to me that ORS 672.020 actually talks about the practice of engineering is prohibited without a valid certificate to actually practice. And I would point out to you that in 672.045, there is an area here where if you don't have a valid license, you are prohibited from providing or engineering kinds of information or holding yourself out as an engineer. There's also another statute, ORS 72.060, which identifies the activities not requiring registration as a professional engineer. And this kind of situation here was not identified in ORS 672.060 as an activity not requiring registration. I think there's all kinds of good reasons not to defer to Mr. Elbert, simply because he's outside his areas of expertise. He doesn't have personal information, personal experience with these kinds of situations. And if anything, he spent less time on the ground than Mr. Buren did or anyone else from Oregon Department of Forestry. And it should be troubling to the judge that Mr. Elbert did not review any records or very few records in anticipation of him testifying today. And he did not ever reduce his opinion. And it's not an expert opinion, but his opinion is some kind of written form. And I think that he was just testifying based upon what his memory was of that site visit that he went to a couple months ago, but he doesn't remember the day. In the final analysis, Mr. Hall's earnest request to have a larger conversation about the Forest Practices Act, the statute, the administrative rules, and what the technological notes mean, that may actually be a reasonable concern on his part, but it's not a concern for the judge. The judge's
determination is in fact limited to that March 23rd, 2022 plan for alternative practice that Mr. Jacobs produced and was apparently vetted by other people within the Oregon Department of Forestry. And so I think that it is clear Mr. Crawl's request for review of this plan was really undertaken with no probable cause to believe that that position could actually be founded. Can't, under the circumstances, convince the judge to expand the scope of the issues at hearing to include the larger issues that Mr. Crawl wants addressed, and that his primary request for filing the request for hearing was for a purpose other than dealing with the plan for alternative practice, but instead beginning the conversation, a more expansive conversation about other issues that he wants to bring up and that are near and dear to his heart, but that is not here today. So, Bighorn requests attorney fees under under the statute 629-672-03100-2, and also requests that the judge not allow or award any kind of fees of any kind to Mr. Crawl under that same statute. Furthermore, Bighorn asked that the plan for alternative practice be affirmed and not otherwise. That I would have here in my notes is that nothing within the plan for alternative practice, I think, limits the ability of Stimson or about how best to deal with the riparian issues in the area where the trees are down. There's nothing there that says that. There could still be an ongoing conversation. And so we'd ask that the plan for alternative practice be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Denley. All right, let's see. I think that's all the closing arguments, Mr. Crawl. I indicated that I would give you a chance to make one final brief statement if you have anything else you want to add. If it's something you said in your earlier closing statement, I don't need to hear it again. But if you have anything else you want to add at this point, Mr. Crawl, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. DeBoer and Mr. Denley are attempting to compartmentalize and confuse the situation. It's actually really very simple. It's about safety, and it's about people's drinking water. The rules are there to protect safety, people's safety, and their drinking water. The state forester is trying to deflect his responsibility for drinking water, blame it on the water master, calling that collaboration with another agency. The collaboration does not absolve the state forester of his duty to properly identify resources that require protection. Drinking water is one of those things. Plans for alternate practice tiers to the written plan that is required by statute. Plans for alternate practice, and so this is OAR 629-605-0173. Plans for alternate practice, this is paragraph 3, plans for alternate practices proposed as part of a written plan shall be subject to the hearings provision. There is no way to evaluate the state forester's comments. Look at everything that underpins that. This is a standalone forest practice. It requires the same kind issue as anything else. And the state forester is going to rely on the existing public safety review. I think I've made a clear case that there are errors and omissions, absolute errors and omissions, in that analysis. The public notification that's been referred to did not work and is still not working. The public is still not being heard here. All we're getting is that it's someone else's fault. It is not possible to review the state forester comments without reference to the studies that support it. One person's professional judgment is not and cannot be the end of the story when we're talking about people's lives and their drinking water. I estimated, and I have not been questioned on that, that actually, I won't even go there. Stimson has made a lot of money. Maybe as much as $10 billion in timber that's been removed from the Pentagon. There's an enormous amount of money here. I'm making nothing. I'm spending money here just on my time, my effort, helps my family, and I'm being shut out here. I don't have a lot to work with. My friend, Ken Albert, is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. He volunteers his time to get out here to give me advice because he knew that I was drunk here. The people down here are just trying to access our own government. This is a reviewable action. The state forester did not follow the zone process. It's about safety and water. That's what it's about. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Krall. All right. Well, I think that's everything then. So at this point, it is, let's see, we're at 5:13 p.m. I'm going to close the record at this time, and I'll issue my written decision within the next 5 business days. And so that will be out shortly to all of you. Make sure you read that carefully. There will be information in that on how to file exceptions if anyone doesn't agree with the proposed order I'm issuing. But there will be time frames within which that must be done. So I want to thank you all very much for your time and your patience. I know this has been a long couple of days, and I appreciate everybody sticking with it. And also for sticking with it with the technical issues this afternoon. I apologize for that, and I appreciate all your time. That's it for me. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.